Chapter 38. This was the end of the line, Pitt thought bitterly. This was as far as any human was expected to go. This was the conclusion of the valiant effort, the future desires and loves and joys of each of them. Their end would come in the water as food for the fish, the pitiful remains of their bodies sinking 1,000 fathoms to the desolate bottom of the sea. Maeve never to see her sons again. Pitt mourned by his mother and father and his many friends at Numa. Giordino's memorial service, Pitt mused with a last vestige of humor, would be well attended, with an impressive number of grieving women, any one of whom could have been a beauty queen. The little boat that had carried them so far through so much chaos was literally coming apart at the seams. The crack along the bottom of the hull lengthened fractionally with every wave that carried the boat over its crest. The buoyancy tubes would keep them afloat, but when the hull parted for good and the pieces went their separate ways, they would all be thrown in the merciless water, clinging helplessly to the wreckage and vulnerable to the ever-present sharks. For the moment, the sea was fairly calm. From crest to trough, the waves rolled just under a meter. But if the weather suddenly became unsettled and the sea kicked up, death would do more than merely stare them in the eyes. The old man with the scythe would embrace them quickly without further hesitation. Pitt hunched over the rudder in the stern, listening to the now familiar scrape and splash of the baler. His intense green eyes, sore and swollen, scanned the horizon as the orb of the morning sun flushed from a golden-orange glow to flaming yellow. He searched, hoping against hope that a hint of land might rise above the clean, straight horizon of the sea surrounding them. He searched in vain. No ship, aircraft, or island revealed itself. Except for a few small clouds trailing to the southeast a good 20 kilometers away, Pitt's world was as empty as the plains of Mars, the boat little more than a pinprick on a vast seascape. After catching enough fish to start a seafood restaurant, hunger was not an anxiety. Their water supply, if conserved, was good for at least another 6 or 7 days. It was the fatigue and lack of sleep caused by the constant bailing to keep the boat afloat that was taking a toll. Every hour was misery. Without a bowl or a bottle of any kind, they were forced to splash the incoming water overboard with their cupped hands until Pitt devised a container from the waterproof packet that held the accessories he had smuggled past the Dorsets. When tied to a pair of wrenches to form a concave receptacle, it could expel a liter of seawater with one scoop. At first they labored in 4-hour shifts, because Maeve demanded she carry her share of the exertion. She worked gamely, fighting the stiffness that soon attacked the joints of her arms and wrists, followed by agonizing muscle aches. The grit and guts were there, but she did not have the natural strength of either man. The shifts soon were divided and allocated by stamina. Maeve bailed for 3 hours before being spelled by Pitt, who struggled for 5.
Giordino then took over and refused any relief until he had put in a full 8 hours. As the seam split farther and farther apart, the water no longer seeped, but rather spurted like a long fountain. The sea pried its way in faster than it could be cast out. With their backs against the wall and no trace of relief in sight, they slowly began to lose their steadfastness. "Damn Arthur Dorset," Pitt shouted in his mind. "Damn Boudicca. Damn Deirdre." The murderous waste, the uselessness of it all made no sense. He and Maeve were no major threat to Dorset's fanatical dreams of empire. Alone, they never could have stopped him, or even slowed him down. It was a pure act of sadism to set them adrift. Maeve stirred in her sleep, murmuring to herself, then lifted her head and stared, semi-conscious, at Pitt.
"Is it my turn to bail?"
"Not for another 5 hours," he lied with a smile. "Go back to sleep." Giordino paused from bailing for a moment and stared at Pitt, sickness in his heart from knowing without question that Maeve would soon be torn limb from limb and devoured by the murder machines of the deep. Grimly he went back to his work, laboring ceaselessly, throwing 1,000 and more containerfuls of water over the side. God only knew how Giordino could keep going. His back and arms must have been screaming in protest. The steel willpower to endure went far beyond the limits of comprehension. Pitt was stronger than most men, but alongside Giordino he felt like a child watching an Olympic weightlifter. When Pitt had yielded the container in total exhaustion, Giordino took it up as if he could go on forever. Giordino, he knew, would never accept defeat. The tough, stocky Italian would probably die trying to get a stranglehold on a hammerhead. Their peril sharpened Pitt's mind. In a final desperate attempt, he lowered the sail, laid it flat in the water, then slipped it under the hull and tied the lines to the buoyancy tubes. The nylon sheet, pressed against the crack by the pressure of the water, slowed the advance of the leakage by a good 50%. But at best it was only a stopgap measure that bought them a few extra hours of life. Unless the sea became perfectly calm, the physical breakdown of the crew and the splitting apart of the boat, Pitt figured, would occur shortly after darkness fell. He glanced at his watch and saw that sunset was only 4.5 hours away. Pitt gently grabbed Giordino's wrist and removed the container from his hand. "My turn," he said firmly. Giordino did not resist. He nodded in appreciation and fell back against the buoyancy tube, too exhausted to sleep. The sail held back the flow of water enough so that Pitt actually stayed even for a short time. He bailed into the afternoon, mechanically, losing all sense of time, barely noting the passage of the brutal sun, never wilting under its punishing rays. He bailed like a robot, not feeling the pain in his back and arms, his senses completely numbed, going on and on as if he were caught in a narcotic stupor. Maeve had roused herself out of a state of lethargy. She sat up and peered dully at the horizon behind Pitt's back.
"Don't you think palm trees are pretty?" she murmured softly.
"Yes, very pretty," Pitt agreed, giving her a tight smile, believing her to be hallucinating. "You shouldn't stand under them. People have been killed by falling coconuts."
"I was in Fiji once," she said, shaking her hair loose. "I saw one drop through the windshield of a parked car."
To Pitt, Maeve looked like a little girl, lost and wandering aimlessly in a forest, who had given up all hope of ever finding her way home. He wished there was something he could do or say that would comfort her. But there was nothing on God's sea that anyone could do. His sense of compassion and utter inadequacy left him embittered.
"Don't you think you should steer more to starboard?" she said listlessly.
"Starboard?" She stared as if in a trance.
"Yes. You don't want to miss the island by sailing past it."
Pitt's eyes narrowed. Slowly, he turned and peered over his shoulder. After nearly 16 days of taking position sightings from the sun and suffering from the glare on the water, his eyes were so strained that he could only focus in the distance for a few seconds before closing them. He cast his eyes briefly across the bow, but saw only blue-green swells. He turned back. "We can no longer control the boat," he explained softly. "I've taken down the sail and placed it under the hull to slow the leakage."
"Oh, please," she pleaded. "It's so close. Can't we land and walk around on dry ground, if only for a few minutes?"
She said it so calmly, so rationally, in her Australian twang, that Pitt felt his spine tingle. Could she actually be seeing something? Reason dictated that Maeve's mind was playing tricks on her. But a still glowing spark of hope mixed with desperation made him rise to his knees while clutching a buoyancy tube for stability. At that moment, the boat rose on the crest of the next swell, and he had a brief view of the horizon. But there were no hills with palm trees rising above the sea. Pitt circled his arm around Maeve's shoulders. He remembered her as robust and spirited. Now she looked small and frail, and yet her face glowed with an intensity that wasn't there before. Then he saw that she was not staring across the sea, but into the sky. For the first time, he noticed the bird above the boat, wings outspread, hovering in the breeze. He cupped his hands over his eyes and gazed at the winged intruder. The wingspan was about a meter, the feathers a mottled green with specks of brown. The upper beak curled and came to a sharp point. To Pitt, the bird appeared to be an ugly cousin of the more colorful parrot family.
"You see it, too," said Maeve excitedly. "Achaea, the same one that led my ancestors to Gladiator Island. Sailors shipwrecked in southern waters swear the Achaea shows the way to safe harbors."
Giordino peered upward, regarding the parrot more as a meal than a divine messenger sent by ghosts to guide them toward dry land. "Ask Polly to recommend a good restaurant," he muttered wearily. "Preferably one that doesn't have fish dishes on the menu." Pitt did not reply to Giordino's survivalist humor. He studied the Kia's movements. The bird hovered as if resting and made no attempt at aimlessly circling the boat. Then, apparently catching its second breath, it began to wing away in a southeasterly direction. Pitt immediately took a compass bearing on the bird's course, keeping it in sight until it became a speck and disappeared. Parrots are not water birds like the gulls and petrels that range far over the seas. Perhaps it was lost, Pitt thought. But that didn't play well. For a bird that preferred to sink its claws on something solid, it made no attempt to land on the only floating object within sight. That meant that it was not tired of flying on instinct toward some unknown mating ground. This bird knew exactly where it was and where it was going. It flew with a plan. Perhaps, just perhaps, it was in the midst of flying from one island to another. Pitt was certain it could see something from a higher altitude that the miserable people in the dilapidated boat below could not. He moved to the control console and pulled himself to his feet, clutching the stand with both hands to keep from being pitched overboard. Again he squinted through swollen eyes toward the southeast. He had become all too familiar with the clouds on the horizon that gave the illusion of land rising from the sea. He was too used to seeing white tufts of cotton drifting over the outer edge of the sea, their uneven shapes and dark gray colors raising false hopes before altering form and gliding onward, driven by winds out of the west. This time it was different. One solitary cloud on the horizon remained stationary while the others moved past it. It rose from the sea faintly, but without any signature of mass. There was no indication of green vegetation because the cloud itself was not a piece of an island. It was formed by vapor rising from sun-baked sand before condensing in a colder level of air. Pitt restrained any feelings of excitement and delight when he realized the island was still a good 5-hour sail away. There wasn't a prayer of reaching it, even with the sail spread once more on the mast while the sea poured into the boat. Then his dashed hopes began to reassemble as he recognized it not as the top of an undersea mount that had thrust above the sea after a million years of volcanic activity and then nurtured lush green hills and valleys. This was a low, flat rock that supported a few unidentifiable trees that somehow survived the colder climate this far south of the tropic zone. The trees, clearly visible, were clustered on the small areas of sand that filled the cracks of the rocks. Pitt now realized the island was much closer than it had seemed at first view. It lay no more than 8 or 9 kilometers away, the tops of the trees giving the impression of a shaggy rug being pulled over the horizon. Pitt took a bearing on the island, noting that it precisely matched the Kia's course. Next he checked the wind direction and drift, and determined that the current would carry them around the northern tip. They would have to sail southeast on a starboard tack, as Maeve had amazingly pictured in her imagination. "The little lady wins a prize," he announced. "We're within sight of land." Both Maeve and Giordino struggled to their feet, clung to Pitt, and gazed at their distant hope of refuge. "She's no mirage," said Giordino with a big grin.
"I told you the Kia would lead us to a safe harbor," Maeve whispered softly in Pitt's ear.
Pitt did not allow himself to be carried away by elation. We're not there yet. We'll have to replace the sail and bail like hell if we're to land on its shore. Giordino judged the distance separating them from the island, and his expression sobered considerably. Our home away from home won't make it, he predicted. She'll split in two before we're halfway.